This episode of The Review was first broadcast on the 21st of January 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and a very warm welcome to The Review, live from Studio One, here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck, and Gillian Tobias.
Coming up on today's programme, we'll be taking a trip around the world to hear what's been selling well in the independent bookstores in Sarajevo, Oslo and Jerusalem, where we visited the American Colony Bookshop.
We have close to 5,000 titles here, which you cannot find anywhere in the Middle East.
We'll also get some musical recommendations from J.D. Beauvalet, editor of the French magazine Les Inrockables.
And we'll be working our way through a stack of great magazines with Ashley Heath, editorial director of Arena En Plus, who'll be joining us live in the studio.
Plus, we learn about the Brazilian singer Michel Telo, who looks set to become the nation's first pop star to make it big around the world.
He's done something which is quite rare in Brazil, which is have a sort of instant pop hit. He's gone from just being a music star to becoming sort of a mainstream celebrity.
All this and more right here on The Review on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Studio One here at Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck, and Gillian Tobias. Well, first of all, can I just say I've looked at the script today and I think there's one or two names I may murder on the way. I did okay in the intro, but we have someone coming on from a French magazine, let's just say.
Yeah.
I'll try and avoid saying the title again because my French isn't the best in the world. But anyway, thank you for having me because it's kind of not my show. This is yours and Tyler's.
I know, but it's nice having you in the driving seat today.
Thank you. I'm not sure why I'm in the. I'm much happier to be the passenger at the moment. Yes, because Tyler is actually, I think he's just landed in Tokyo this morning. He's there for Monocle. But I did see him in the last couple of days because we've just been in Zurich for 3 days. So listeners may have known that we did the Midori Houses for 2 days from Zurich.
But it was really nice listening in London. It gives it a really special feel when you're presenting actually from a completely different city and you get a whole different cast of characters. And I think the Swiss programmes were really, really good. How did you
Yeah, it's good. It's funny because you can suddenly do something very in-depth, whereas normally for the shows you're trying to book, people across several different subjects. Here it was just kind of getting in a lot of people to talk about Switzerland, brand Switzerland, doing business in Switzerland. And yeah, we met amazing people over 2 days. And then we did an event with Kuoni for our subscribers in Zurich. So I think we had about 150 people through a really great party that was done in conjunction with them. And so again, just great meeting the Swiss readership and meeting the people who are kind of who have supported us from day one.
And did you go around the magazine and bookshops there? How well?
Yes, I did. And also, I'm always promoting the Urbanist, but I should promote it even more. I was there making two or three packages for the Urbanist as well. So we did a piece about the world of the tram and Swiss trams, and it has one of the highest uses of tram use anywhere in the world. And then I did a good architecture story, and we met a couple other people to do the regular sort we have on the Urbanist tool stories. So yeah, there's going to be a lot of Zurich kind of spreading that Swiss vibe, like a good fondue is going to be dripping over the programmes for days to come.
All right. Well,
it's a bit of a funny image, but I think it works. Almost.
Look forward to it.
Should we move on?
We shall move on. You're listening to The Review on Monocle 24.
And it's the time of the week where we get to hear what's flying off the shelves at some of the best independent bookshops around the world.
So first up is Sarajevo, where our reporter Zoran Kubra went down to buy books. Now, Buy Books is considered one of the best bookshops in the city and a popular place to read, have a coffee or a glass of wine. He met with the Bosnian writer and co-owner Goran Samardic.
I'm Goran Samardic, owner of Buy Book. I'm a professor of literature and writer. Our bookstore was founded in 1997 by me and my colleague, writer Damir Zunovic. At that time, our bookstore was unique place because one could find book only in our place from Croatia, Serbia, and other countries of ex-Yugoslavia. We are working in the center of the city. We have a coffee shop. I forgotten to say, we are also a very important published house called Buy Book. Yeah. The most popular book in our bookstore is a book from Noel Malcolm, A Short History of Bosnia. We translated this in Bosnian and we sold many copies of that book. We have also One Day from David Nichols, we change the windows every 7 days. We have a book, as every bookstore in the world, as Stephanie Meyer, and almost every book of Orhan Pamuk, Ljosa, and Herta Miller, and so on. We are expecting a book of one famous Bosnian football player, a book by Zlatan Ibrahimović. We have a problem now with this, and many people waiting for the title.
That was Goran Samardžić from the Buy Bookshop in Sarajevo. Next, we travel to Jerusalem, where Josef Darner went to meet Munter Fahmi, owner of the American Colony Bookshop.
My name is Munter Fahmi. I'm the owner of the bookshop here at the American Colony Hotel in East Jerusalem. The hotel is really an institution. It's a very beautiful old hotel that has been, old building, I should say. Hotel, I think, started only about 30 years ago. The shop here has been in business for 15 years now. When I started it back in 1997, 98, it was the only bookshop in the whole Middle East that covers topics, huge varieties of books on the history and of the conflict and the politics of it. And it also has the largest selection of international literature, translated literature into English. So we have close to 5,000 titles here. Which you cannot find anywhere in the Middle East, between literature and fiction and writing. So we also cover a lot of things that deals with the Middle East. So if it's travel writings, you will find, for example, a lot of books written by Wilfred Thesigers, by William Dalrymple, and things like that, or Peter Hopkirk, and also guide books about the Middle East, gender studies that deals with the issues of the Middle East. Islam, of course, is a big issue here. And we tend to have our biographies that are geared by Middle Eastern scholars or celebrities or leaders and things like that. And then we have a little bit of everything. I mean, we have like memoirs of an economic hitman about the World Bank and things like that. Right now, we sell a lot of the King's Council book on Jordan by Jack O'Connell. He was the chief CIA in Jordan and a very close associate of the late King Hussein. We also have been selling, and this is the number one bestseller in the bookshop for the last 12 years, a book called The Iron Wall by Avi Schleim, which is published by Penguin in the UK and W.W. Norton in America. William Dalrymple books from the Holy Mountain is also among the top books. But we have been, you know, like lately, the latest is The Line in the Sand, which covers the Middle East period with the British Mandate and things. That's also selling well. And, you know, the latest literature we receive almost weekly. We get the Booker Prize winners, the Nobel Prize winners. This book is selling really well here. The Hair with the Amber Eyes. Another book that's selling nonfiction is, it's an older book, Diplomatic Baggage, because we have a lot of expat community here. So this talks about a woman who follows around her husband because he's a diplomat. We have a lot of diplomats, journalists, social workers, researchers, expats who are working in a lot of different NGOs. These people are the one our main customers. Then we have very few Palestinians and less Israelis. There's a new book written by a British writer named Arthur Neslin. It's about how is it to be Palestinian. The latest also book we will have, The Sacred Trash, which is about the lost and found world of the Cairo Geniza, very old manuscripts that were found in Cairo. It's written by Peter Cole and his partner Dina Hoffman.
That was Munter Fahmi, owner of the American Colony Bookshop in Jerusalem. I mean, what fabulous potential to curate a book, a bookstore in a hotel in that part of the world.
Yeah, and it's amazing that the kind of the roll call of books he's got, and over 5,000 titles. But I love the idea that the kind of bestseller, it's been the same bestseller for 12 years.
Yeah. No, I mean, yeah.
So you can obviously do quite a lot of business from one or two books if you're very if you're very clever.
Or a lazy bookseller.
He could just stock five books maybe and probably sell as many books almost. But it's also interesting that things like, you know, The Hair with the Amber Eyes, William Dalrymple, these are kind of, you know, for anybody who travels, these seem to be like the classic books of the moment. They're kind of books that everybody really loves.
I mean, I'd love to see a bookstore like that also have a really good sort of second-hand book section, because I think, again, in in that part of the world in Jerusalem. It'd be really interesting, the books that people read and then sort of return back.
Because that is the bizarre thing when you check into many hotels where they allow people to kind of leave their cast-off books of the summer for you to, you know, pick up and read as well. And there's normally, they're always awful. There was some horrible kind of like cheap, kind of nasty book. And then there's normally a page missing where, yeah, someone tore a page out for their chewing gum or something. So you read half a book.
Disappointing.
I remember years and years ago when I was traveling around India, and everywhere you stayed, every little kind of inn would have like a pile of these books that you could borrow, and they were also kind of worn out and dusty. They seem to have been left there since the 1960s or something.
But I do that. I mean, when I'm on holiday, I leave a book, and I often leave it in a cafe or I leave it on a park bench. I do kind of like the idea that someone will pick up.
Well, there is that system, isn't there, where people do leave books around, and you're meant to kind of pass them on, and you leave them on the tube, and you leave them. I don't know whether you know if it was lost property or it was deliberate. That's the problem.
Or you're stealing someone's book. Okay, well, let's move on to our final bookshop this week. We travelled to Oslo, where our reporter, Andreas Lidvig, went to the Trosmo bookshop. That's right in the heart of the city and a stone's throw from the Royal Palace. He met there with the general manager, who is also a poet, Tarjei Thorsson, and the bookseller, Jørgen Vikki.
My name is Tarjei Thorsson. I work at Trosmo Bokhandel in Oslo. We are almost the only independent quality bookshop in Norway. We're a specialized bookshop, or we're what the bookshop used to be in the old days. We stock the full range of books. And we have the oldest comic specialty department in Norway. And we'll be 40 years old in 1.5 years. Oh, the hits of the week. I don't remember. We have to look up the chart. But it's very different from all other bestseller lists. The whole point of this bookshop, or the whole philosophy behind it, is that we handpick every title we stock. So we try to choose away things, you know, get rid of the rubbish and just stock what we think people need to read. Books that look outward towards the world, not inwards towards ourselves. I'm now standing just next to a brilliant short story collection. It's American. It was published last year. It's called Crimes in Southern Indiana. It's the first book by an industry worker, and it's probably the hardest, darkest book I've read since I read Celine, Journey to the End of Night. Or we can just move over to... I think Steven Greenblatt, The Swerve, is a really good book. He writes about how modernity has been changing and what modernity is today. Basically, it's a book about our existence today and how we ended up here. And I must say, the prospects for the future, they're not too bright, but they've never been.
My name is Jørgen Rike, and I work in Trosmo Bokhandel. Among other things, I'm doing the windows, putting the exhibitions in the windows. In the window at the moment that we're looking at now, my favorites. The photography books always comes first. There's a classic I like, Anders Petersen, Café Lemitz, from Germany, the end of the 60s. And there is a new one by Jiho Engström and Margot Wallard, Foreign Affair. It's from a small Japanese publisher. And the Norwegian photographer Morten Andersen, of course, always present. Among the other books, we have a novel called Imot Naturen, Against Nature, I guess, by Thomas Espedal. Yeah.
Well, that was Jørgen Rikki from the Trosmo bookshop in Oslo. And what a jolly bunch they were. I was almost crying by the end of that. I don't think anyone goes in there to buy a cartoon book, do they?
Well, he was a poet.
Oh, dear. Anyway, can you cheer us up now, Jørgen, please?
Okay, so we move from books to music. Our global review continues now when we hear some of the latest recommendations from the French music scene right after this.
The February issue of Monocle has a warm glow as we look at how charm adds longevity to brands, makes offices great places to work, and keeps people returning to the same restaurants year after year. But there's more.
In the design section, we take a closer look at charm and profile 10 companies around the world that are nailing it. We also kick back on the beach in New Zealand in Herbst Architect's latest creation.
Plus, there's our Japan travel survey, a visit to a jail turned craft school in Charleston, a neighbourhood to call home in Stockholm, and a rugged tale from Tehran. The February issue of Monocle is on newsstands now or available via subscription at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world. And welcome back to The Review here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck, and Gillian DeBias. Now, every week we like to get some recommendations from the music industry, and today we're joined on the line by J.D. Beauvallet, editor of the French magazine Les Inroctibles. Welcome, J.D., and I hope I haven't murdered the name of your magazine too badly there.
No, you've done extremely well.
Thank
you. It's a crazy name. I know we should have changed it right from the beginning, but we didn't.
Now,
we were told it was a mistake when we started 25 years ago.
I wanted to point out that actually you're normally based in Paris, but we have you in the English seaside town of Brighton today.
Yeah, that's correct. Yes, I live in between Paris and Brighton.
Oh, so it's not you're just here on a... I thought it was very strange that you'd not gone to like Cannes or Nice for your holidays, that you were coming to the English seaside.
Well, it is a French, the English Riviera, isn't it?
So tell me about the magazine. You you started it 25 years ago.
Yes, it started basically as a fanzine. A fanzine that was really fed up with a set of music press in France. There was a lot of bands coming from England, from America, nobody would talk about, or even some emerging new French bands nobody talked about. And we said we start a fanzine with just friends, and the fanzine became a monthly magazine, and it became a weekly magazine.
And what's, apart from music, you do cover other subjects as well, don't you? You do some politics, you do some reportage.
Yes, exactly. But 15 years ago now, we've decided that we've gone round really all the music stars we really wanted to talk to, and we needed to broaden our horizons, if you like. And basically, we started talking about politics, about sports, about way of life, about art, about literature a lot, and basically became a kind of a cultural magazine, even if I don't like the word cultural, it sounds very boring, and you imagine you portray some guy with a pipe and a tweed jacket. But
so the main focus is music. I mean, how important are sort of music festivals for you to sort of discover your sort of music picks and choices?
Well, music was the starting point of the magazine. I mean, we started with music, and we've developed through music. We've doing a festival in Paris that's been going on for 25 years as well, a big music festival. So we always really desperate to discover new sounds. We got a huge network of people all around the world sending us sounds, sending us links to websites. So we are very keen to discover music, whether it comes from festival, from the internet, from wherever. Really, we are always looking for new music. I mean, I would be devastated to know that there's a great song somewhere in the world I haven't heard.
And just tell me a little bit about the business model for the magazine. How many times do you publish a year? And is it nearly all sales within France? And how important is the website now to you?
Well, website is very important. We've been developing it since the beginning. Before, actually, the internet, there was something in France called the Minitel, which was the ancestor of the internet. We were already on Minitel, so we've been on that field forever. We've got a South American version of the magazine published from Buenos Aires, which is doing extremely well in Argentina. And otherwise, obviously, it's only the French-speaking world because both the website and the magazine are in French. So we're doing well in Quebec, in Belgium, and in Switzerland. We're selling a bit in England because there's 400,000 French people living in London. So we do, reach this audience as well. But apart from that, it's mostly French-speaking world.
So you've picked some songs for us today. So I think we're going to have a little listen to the first track, which is We Are Young by Juveniles.
JD, can you just tell us a little bit about that pick? Who are the Juveniles?
Sorry, I didn't hear the question.
I'm just saying, could you just tell us a little bit about that pick? Who are the Juveniles?
Well, they're just a very new young band coming from Brittany, and they're quite typical of that new generation of French bands who don't care about what was the old rules, that you should sing in French, that was the only way to be played on the radio stations in France, the only way to get signed on a French record company was to sing in French. And they just realized someday we've found like air or Phoenix or Daft Punk or Justice, but you didn't really need to sing in French to have a career, and you could do the music you want. And these kids did exactly what they wanted, very stubborn kids, and they finally signed to a very prestigious label called Kitsune, which is a very, very cool French label.
Is there a bit of a sort of homegrown music scene in Brittany? Is this a kind of little hotbed for new music talent?
It's always been Brittany, the hotbed for new music, because of one festival called Transmusical, which is, takes place in Rennes every year in the winter, in December. And it's a huge music festival. And basically it's created a whole scene around the festival. So Brittany, Normandy, are always been very strongholds, and they're close to Britain. I mean, these guys travel regularly, there's flights, there's ferries going to England, so they come to London, they buy the records, they know exactly what's going on.
And we should just point out that actually Kitsune is a good friend of Monocle as well. We've done quite a lot with the world of Messiah, Maison Kitsune and the Kitsune brand. Now, they obviously are putting out CDs themselves. Do you produce music? Are you making CDs? Are you selling music through the internet?
We're putting out box sets constantly. We've done a lot of compilations. Les Inrock are very famous for their compilations. We started making them about 25 years ago. Covermont CDs or CDs in the shop. So we love to do compilation. And we've got a website as well, which is entirely dedicated to young French bands that are unsigned. And we do a lot of advertising for them. And every year we pick one. That's a big winner, and most of them get signed and get like a big promotion, so it's always very exciting to do that. And that proves how much there is going on at the moment in France. There's loads and loads of new bands.
And is that an important part of your business, actually, making money from those sales?
It is. Making money from the box set is quite a big big thing for us. It's very exciting to do as well, because it's like showing, giving something to hear, which is exactly what the magazine is. You read the magazine and you at the same time you hear the soundtrack to the magazine. But as well, it's a very good business for us, and we do it a lot. We refuse to be a record company. I mean, we've been offered to do like to sign some of our new discoveries, to sign them directly through the magazine, through a major company, to create, if you like, a label within the company. We don't want to do that, because you can't actually be a judge and as well at the same time publish music yourself. So it's very complicated to be both a journalist and a record company. You can't do that.
Well, should we try and get some more promotion for your box sets going here? Could you name the next artist you've chosen for us today?
Yes, it's Dominica. It's almost a veteran, and there's a big reissue of all his catalogue at the moment. Oh, toi, dis tout bas, on dansait. C'était plutôt inhabituel. Alors, bien sûr, j'en profitais. De bras en bras, les gens passaient. Ça n'était qu'un temps court pour se relancer. Et puis, se remettre à danser. Parfois j'entendais quelqu'un m'appeler, personne quand je me tournais. Au 22 bar ce soir-là, on dansait. Je ne sais plus pourquoi c'était, non. Pas plus que les gens qui dansaient. Si par hasard ils s'arrêtaient et ils sentaient de vieux décors se balancer, plusieurs fois manquer de tomber. Et du coup de bras en bras ils repassaient. Alors on se laissait aller au 22 bar ce soir-là. Parfois j'entendais quelqu'un m'appeler, personne quand je me tournais.
Au 22 bar ce soir. Ah,
chaque fois que je le voyais. Je l'appelais puis il me cachait. Après tout ce qu'il m'avait fait.
That was Le 22 Bar by Dominique, as recommended by J.D. Beauvallon. Are you discovering anything in Brighton while you're there?
Yes, well, we always do hunting, basically. I spend my life. There's a French music festival, actually, I'm involved with next weekend in Brighton, inviting both bands from France and from England. Francophile bands from England, so that's going to be quite exciting. But yeah, there's so much music coming out of Brighton constantly. So in last week's magazine, there was a review by a local band called Odd Fellows Casino, who are fantastic.
And can you just quickly tell us, for people who don't know, who Dominique R is?
Well, Dominique R was one of these first French guys in the 90s to modernize, if you like, the chanson, which is a very French style of music. You know, you've got Jacques Brel, you've got Barbara, you've got all these big classic chansons françaises, as we call it, from the 60s. And he sort of modernized it in the 90s with great success. He's the kind of guy who listened to both French music, typical French music from the 60s, and at the same time was listening to Joy Division and all these English or American bands. So it sort of mixed the two together and created this new movement called Nouvelle Chanson. And he's still around and he's still a fantastic performer, and he's created so many vocations. There's so many bands who came after him.
Well, JD, next time you're in Brighton, perhaps you'd like to take the train up to London. I think we could have you in for one morning to do a bit of DJing here for us on Monocle 24. But thank you so much for your picks this morning. It's certainly cheered us up after our trip to Norway. Thank you very much indeed. Speak to you soon. You're listening to The Review on Monocle 24.
If you've missed any of your favourite programmes on Monocle.com, tune in or download The Curator, our Sunday roundup of the best of the week's programmes on Monocle 24. With a different editor hosting every week, The Curator is your quick and easy way into the week's stories on Monocle 24. That's The Curator, brought to you in association with Rolex, right here on Monocle 24, every Sunday at 1300 London time, or via our timeshare player on Monocle.com and on iTunes.
Every month, Monocle deploys over 70 writers and photographers to over 50 countries to deliver our print edition. Covering a unique mix of global affairs, business, culture and design, Monocle publishes 10 magazine editions a year and 2 special newspapers during the summer and winter holiday seasons. With a subscription to Monocle, you'll not only be the first to receive the magazine, you'll also be invited to special events and receive our iconic tote bag from Rutote of Japan. Subscribe to Monocle from £80 sterling at our website at shop.monocle.com/subscriptions. Subscribe to Monocle and keep an eye on the world.
For a complete briefing on the business of design, join us for Section D. Every week, Monocle's design editor, Hugo MacDonald, brings you the world of design in a perfectly formed package, looking at architecture, industrial design, fashion, retail, and graphics. Monocle 24's Section D brings the world of design to you, the Monocle listener. That's Section D, premiering every Tuesday on Monocle 24 at 1900 London time here on Monocle 24, and also available on our timeshift player at monocle.com and on iTunes.
Welcome back, and it's Saturday, in case you hadn't noticed, and you're listening to The Review with me, Andrew Tuck, and Gillian DeBias.
Now we have a fresh new pile of magazines in front of us, and to help us review them today, we are joined in studio by Ashley Heath, Editorial Director of Arena On Plus. And today we're going to be focusing on men's magazines. Welcome, Ashley.
Good afternoon.
So you have a good pile in front of you. My eye is drawn to that big Tom there. Can you talk to us a little bit about fashion for men?
I mean, what interested me when you invited me on today is I'd had this pile of men's magazines that I was struggling to even want to pick up. And Fashion for Men is just extraordinary. It's this new magazine that's come out. It must be about 500 pages. It's hardback. If you buy it on the stands, if you can find it, it's £22. And I have to say, it's a beautiful title, but it really is a fantastic example of where a sector of the magazine industry is going, which is how can you get any more indulgent in terms of a magazine? Because literally, to even carry this thing home requires a driver.
Now, it's done by, I see, by Milan Vukmirovic, who used to be a designer, didn't he, at Jill Sander. I see he's shot some of the stories in here. He's written some of the pieces. Is he a bit of a Renaissance man trying to pull off this publication?
Well, he actually says this is not a magazine. It's a love letter to the fashion industry. It's a big love letter, a longer love letter than I've ever written. And I've written a few. He is a Renaissance man, and there's this whole sector of the magazine industry now that seems to be, virtually reflections of their publishers, stroke editors, stroke creative directors. And I don't think any of us are naive. We know that they're often pitching for other work. I find that quite interesting, and I guess also we live in some ways in a post-Monocle environment, and you guys are running Monocle alongside Wink Creative, but there's a number of magazines now that seem to operate on this basis, that the magazine is perhaps less about communicating with an audience and not even just satisfying fashion advertisers, but it's virtually a sort of CV stroke pitch for work elsewhere in the industry, industry.
And how do you balance that with your own title there? Because whenever you get some of the best kind of creative people in the industry in fashion, they always want to do these things because they're not going to be paid huge salaries for doing this in comparison to commercial work, but it is seen as a way of getting their name out there and of being allowed to experiment. How do you balance that desire to have the best names and give them some freedom to do with what they want, and also the idea that actually in the end somebody is opening this magazine perhaps because they want to buy a pair of trousers, they want to be told something that's not about selling someone else's career?
How do I manage it on a personal level?
Yeah, when you're running a magazine.
I think it's difficult when you're approaching people and asking them to do ambitious projects, sometimes on limited budgets, to not give them a bit of free rein to showcase themselves for other projects, future work, etc. In terms of my magazines, so Arena Hon Plus and also Pop, one of my obsessions since I took Pop back on and also rejigged Arena Hon Plus in the last year was actually I really am quite obsessed now with covers and the kind of front covers that I could publish that could grab the eye on the newsstands and communicate, i.e. grab an audience. So to answer your question, but not really, my obsession is a little bit to swim against the current, as it were. So having sort of semi-invented Arena Hon Plus in the 90s, and I see, these titles, which are in many respects, it might sound arrogant, but it's pretty much true. There's all these titles that are virtually Arena Hon Plus Me Too's, except they're Me Millions, because you go into Soho magazine stand or Soho news agents now, and there's literally dozens and dozens and dozens of fashion magazines. And I wonder, I wonder where all the trees are. But a lot of them are really to be applauded in terms of everyone's experimenting with interesting paper stocks. Everyone's trying to, get often a passionate fashion message across. But my obsession has been a little bit to get back to magazine basics and the stuff I learned at The Face right at the start of my magazine career, which is doing strong covers that catch the eye and maybe have a bit of a talk about factor. And I don't see that in the market because these magazines aren't really for selling. In the case of Fashion for Men, which we picked on at the start, I don't even see how you can get it in the newsagents, but I don't even see how you can get it to subscribers. It's so ridiculously heavy. That said, it's beautiful. The paper's lovely. It smells great. But it's a bewildering market to me, and it's one that, as I said, these titles sit on my desk now and I don't even pick them up and look at them. And it was sort of a joy today to have to give them a few hours in order to try and talk eloquently with you guys this afternoon.
Now, but tell me, so we've got other titles here, Fantastic Man, Another Man. When you imagine these editors go or their publishers go and knock on the doors of fashion advertisers, Do you think it's hard for them actually to point out what the difference is between these titles? Because in the end, surely if I'm buying a page of advertising in your magazine or if I want to write for you, you need to have some kind of clear distinction of what makes you different from all the other titles. And this kind of me-tooism you talk about, I wonder how actually you can sustain all these titles at the same time.
Well, I think that is the big question, and I think we're going to see a lot of changes in the marketplace moving forward, not least because the fashion advertisers have had enough. And I think now they are looking at a variety of other avenues to spend their money. So to answer the question, if it was a question, yes, there's too many magazines, and I don't think enough of them, if any of them, really have a strong USP, if you like. I think Fantastic Man, everyone knows, has came in and almost post on Plus grabbed a moment and has been very copied, not just by other magazines, but in my opinion, if you look at the Mr. Porter online sales site, that seemed to be very inspired by Fantastic Man and the world of Fantastic Man. So that did come along with a tone that's been influential. But I think it must be bewildering for the fashion advertisers to have all these magazines coming to them, to be honest.
Well, the fresh air that Fantastic Man brought was actually quite humorous. It didn't seem always to be completely po-faced about the world of fashion, and it had some wit. And even when you read now, that just the way they do their captioning, there's some humour in there, I think.
Yeah, absolutely, and originality, and a kind of genius in borrowing from publishing tropes, techniques of the past, and modernising them. That was, I think, the real genius of that title, and that they're trying to obviously repeat that now in the women's market with Gentlewoman.
Now, the titles you've brought in today, is there anything that did stand out for you as an interesting development in publishing?
Well, you're not going to be totally surprised when I say no. I think what was interesting, actually, is I looked at the new L'Uomo Vogue, and I hadn't looked at Francesca Cesani's men's title for a while, because it felt honestly like it was being done on a bit of a budget with not many fashion shoots. But I was quite impressed at the lineup of men, real men, and people I'm quite interested in, that they'd managed to shoot and shoot in fashion. By and large, Italian fashion, but no problem. So I was actually really impressed, in a way, most by Italian L'Uomo Vogue, which I didn't expect to be. It seemed, when I looked across them, so there were completely new titles, Fashion for Men and another magazine called Matter, which is seems to me to be very much in the market that 032C in Berlin is part of, which it calls itself technology, style and conceptual art. But I think what's interesting is more and more magazines seem to realise you have to have a landscape, a lifestyle landscape, to hang men's fashion on. So there was this big boom in men's fashion, I think, in edgy men's fashion, excuse me, with Raf Simons, and then I think with Hedi Slimane and what he did at Saint Laurent and Dior. And I think at that point, there was a big interest in men's fashion and men's fashion magazines. I guess we were in that post-Gucci, post-Prada boom in fashion anyway, and there was more money around in terms of advertising for the men's side of the big fashion houses. But I think just doing men's fashion magazines that are just jackets, shirts and trousers, even with, some 17-year-old boy with a bowl head haircut, ran its course. So you now see titles looking to give a landscape to sell fashion in, which to me is great, because it's what, to be, to be truthful, I've always tried to do with all the magazines I've been involved with, to give a kind of broader landscape that fashion feels exciting in. But suddenly you see all these magazines. So Hercules in Barcelona has reinvented itself as Hercules Universal, and it's all about travel now. In fact, it seems to me very post-Monaco, to blow smoke up your ass, which I understand a Monaco man. The Monaco man quite enjoys. What was the other redesign? And there was a redesign as well of Man About Town, which has been a magazine I've quite liked. It was a sort of Fantastic Man copycat, but now they've given it over to M&M Paris, and it's completely bewildering in that I look at the cover, which is an M&M illustration stroke piece of art, in inverted commas, and I just don't understand how anyone would ever pick it up on the newsstands. So, mixed response, and I guess I'm left feeling, wow, that's a lot of magazines and a lot of nice paper to sell some trousers and jumpers.
On a slightly different subject, whenever you go and see fashion houses now, there is often discussion about, you know, what they're doing online and why online is important for their sales and how they're trying to explore the kind of digital world. But here we're looking, as you say, a lot of print and a lot of actually advertising that, you know, to be honest, looks good on paper. Mm. When you're doing your magazine these days, do you find there's an increased pressure for people to find something they can do online with you as well? Or do you still think that, you know, great advertising just looks great on a crisp piece of paper?
Well, I'm a big fan advocate of print because it's what I'm experienced in and it's where my passion is. There's most definitely for at least 5, if not more years, been this big emphasis on what are you going to do online? And my view on that is I've not been very proactive. I mean, saying that, I was involved in the setting up of a social network site a long time ago, 10 years ago, which I enjoyed. But when I was employed by EMAP and now I did a little bit of consultancy for Condé Nast and now I'm virtually head-to-head with Condé Nast, I go in to see companies like Burberry, for instance, who say it's all about online for us. And I listen to what the big magazine companies are doing, and I don't think there's still not a business strategy there. It still doesn't add up, it doesn't make sense. So I think, like a lot of people, I'm now very, very comfortable in this more traditional media space of doing fantastic, beautiful magazines. It's what I believe I'm good at, and in some ways I'm dodging the whole on fashion online problem. I believe you can capture fashion with moving image and put it online beautifully, and I've done some of that. You know, we're shooting a lot now with the Canon, we've shot with Red cameras, but the truth is it's more expensive to the production costs are much higher, and by and large the money you can get to sustain these kind of projects is actually less. So I don't see the business model. And I've looked at what, for instance, you know, Vogue has done internationally, and I've not been impressed. So in my business, it's not as high a priority as you might imagine.
Well, Ashley, thank you very much for coming in to see us this morning and to give us your views on the world of men's magazines. We're going to go straight across to a report now from Sheena Rossiter, who... She's been looking at the Brazilian artist Michel Teló, who is set to be the kind of first Brazilian to be a proper pop star around the world. Obviously, there are many Brazilian artists we know in all sorts of fields, but this is a proper pop star and already is having hits in Germany, Italy and the Netherlands. And this is her report.
Nossa, nossa, assim você me mata. Ai, seu...
You've probably heard this song by now, whether you like it or not. Aí se eu te pego, or If I Catch You in English, is the number one pop hit that catapulted Brazilian country music star Michel Teló into international superstardom nearly overnight. For a song that started out as a joke, it's gone viral over the past few months. Hits for Teló's official video on YouTube keep multiplying as he's become the pop culture man of the moment. At last glance, his official video had nearly 120 million views, and that's not even touching on the foreign language versions. In fact, you can find a Dutch version by popular Dutch singer and television presenter Gerald Joling. A few French teens gathered around and did a version of the song in their language. Some Italians did the same. For those who like reggaeton, they can check out this version. And for Anglophiles, just last week, Teló himself even recorded an English version of the song.
Ai Se Eu Te Pego is very catchy. I think nobody can listen to Ai Se Eu Te Pego without stamping your feet. It's music for a party, I would say that.
That's journalist Humberto Maia Jr. He spent 5 days with the music star doing everything with him, from going to his concerts, to eating hamburgers, to fishing, while he was writing the cover story for the Brazilian news magazine Epoca, which was on stands at the beginning of January.
I think he tried to imitate.
As we flip through the pages of the Epoca article on Teló, Humberto points to the bottom left-hand corner of the page, where we can see a small-sized Teló acting out the choreography to his Aí Se Eu Te Pego dance, which, if we turn the magazine's pages fast enough, we can see Teló acting out the dance moves as if the magazine were a flipbook. He fans himself to the left, then the right, gestures for you to get closer, and then come the hip thrust. With a catchy beat and a dance to go with it, Humberto tells me why he thinks Teló's song has become so popular.
I think Michel Teló's song fulfilled a very restricted space, which is the taste for foreign songs, exotic songs. I would say that Aí Se Eu Te Pego is the Macarena of the 21st century, because I think from time to time, Europeans and Americans, and they want to see something different. We had the salsa, we have the Spanish songs, the Mexican songs, and now it was time for a Brazilian song.
And everybody's singing along.
In the Sao Paulo neighborhood, Jardim Paulista, I sit and watch Teló's official video on YouTube with British journalist Dom Phillips. Lyric by lyric, Dom breaks down the song and explains its unique beat.
Michel Teló's hit is actually a mix of two musical styles. There's one called Sertanejo, which is a sort of Brazilian country music, which is really popular in the interior. And the other is Forró, which is a sort of an accordion-led dance music from the northeast. He's sort of mixed the two. He's done something which is quite rare in Brazil, which is have a sort of instant pop hit, which seems to have caught the imagination of a lot of people. He's gone from just being a music star to becoming sort of a mainstream celebrity.
But as Dom tells me, the new mixture of two musical genres isn't what's attracting attention. It's the fact that Teló's hit song is showing signs of breaking down Brazil's rigid class barriers.
It's a phenomenon which is interesting because there's a lot of social division in Brazil, and the Brazilian middle-class intellectual elite doesn't really like to engage in popular culture. It either prefers to ignore it, treat it as anthropological phenomena, or attack it. Brazil's never really had an international pop star, not since Carmen Miranda, which is actually, she was born in Portugal, and that's 40 years ago. So they've now got this situation where they've got one, but they think it's a little bit cheesy. So it's causing them a lot of dilemmas. They can't really handle it. When I put the Michel Teló video on my Facebook, I had all these people complaining about it. It's like, why are you complaining? As a Brazilian pop star is becoming successful abroad, you know? What's the problem?
Humberto agrees with Dom that Teló's new style of Brazilian country music has taken the genre away from the AM radio days when country music was associated with poverty in Brazil.
21st century, there was a new wave of Brazilian country music that can be called student country music. These songs are very appealing among college students. They talk about parties and dates and having fun. And that kind of country music reached the higher classes and the young rich Brazilians. And Teló now is the most representative singer of the college country music, because not only his songs talk to his public, his style is very familiar to the young people who live in the biggest city in Brazil. The first country musicians, they used to use in hat and this America country style. You don't see this much in São Paulo or Rio. Teló uses the fashion from the big streets. He used Dolce & Gabbana, Armani, and I think when his public sees him, they see themselves.
In the middle of one of three massive dance floors that resemble a Western saloon, here at Sao Paulo's nightclub Villa Country, I'm surrounded by Michel Teló fans. Aí Se Eu Te Pego comes on, and the choreographed moves come out as the crowd enthusiastically sings and dances along.
Michel Teló, claro. Você é bom.
Ela é bom.
Também gosto.
Three girls in short, fashionable dresses tell me how much they like him. And then I meet Eduardo, a serious country music fan. Wearing a 40-gallon white cowboy hat, tight Wrangler jeans, and snakeskin boots, he's been coming to Villa Country for 10 years to dance to country music. And even though Michel Teló differs from traditional Brazilian country music, he's still a fan.
I like him a lot. Brazil is very patriotic. When Brazilians have a lot of success abroad, we support them and we feel very proud of their success. With Michel Teló, we're proud because he's playing all over the world. He's having global success with this song that started out as a joke, and now it's a global hit.
Numa brincadeira, né? Se tornou hit mundial, né?
Back in Jardim Paulista with Dom, he says that Teló's success among the masses shows the rest of the world a part of Brazil that isn't internationally known.
The Michel Teló is interesting because it's really a song that is about where young Brazil and Brazilian pop culture is at today. And I think in many ways the perception of Brazil abroad is still based on the cliches of traditional samba and the football. And Brazil today is a very modern country. It's a very technologically hooked up country. It really likes Brazilian country music. It's very consumerist. It's very, very interested in sex and relationships and gossip. And Michel Teló really is all these things coming together because it's a massive internet hit. He's a country singer in a Czech shirt. He's a young blonde kid. And like it or not, that pretty much is the sound of, you know, 20-something Brazil.
For Monocle, in São Paulo, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
And that's going to bring us to the end of the Saturday Review. For now, it's goodbye from all of us here, producer Katie Bobeur, researcher Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our sound engineer, Jamie King. You've been listening to The Review with me, Andrew Tuck, and Gillian Tobias.